Welcome back to the GCT Podcast, episode 19.5. This is the redo on last week's recording, which some tech retard managed to not record. But we had an amazing conversation. Today I'm joined by Jeremy Fraser, Jason Singleton, and Jono the Raven Hopwood. So last week, firstly, welcome, lads. Last week we had a great conversation around our top three things we've learned as personal trainers or coaches. Scintillating as it was, we didn't record it. So we're back this week and a bit of a concern around repetition and maybe not finding the same chemistry. So we've cracked a bottle of port to lube us up a little bit and really get into it. But we'll see how we go. Look, let's go through the same format. So we're each going to work through one of our top three at a time, and we'll just riff off that. Our listeners tend to be a mix of personal trainers and fitness enthusiasts, and let's face it, just fans. And I think there's a lot of good lessons and good insights into, you know, what it takes to be a successful trainer. You guys have all had sustained success over an extended period of time, so these insights are probably quite profound, because from the outside, the fitness industry probably looks very different to what it is, and coaching probably looks very different to what it is. It's not just reps, chicken and broccoli, but it's everything else that goes with it. So Jeremy, you can kick us off with the first of your top three lessons.
Cool. All right, so my first lesson was something essentially that I underrated to start with. Through the beginning of my career, I didn't value really, really frequent communication as much as I do now. So I would get on different pages with a client with their goals or whatever, and so the plan wouldn't be customized as much as it could have been for their specific goal at the time point. So that's something that I underrated. Of course, I always knew that honest communication was so integral to a good relationship with coach and client. But just the frequency and just the openness, like through consultations, I think I learned a lot through that. So patient and frequent communication. Another one, an example of that, was just during lockdown, just when everyone's situation changed, everyone's goals had to change alongside them. There's no point of having like a maximal strength goal when you're in lockdown if you can't train with that equipment, of course. So we had to change it a little bit, for example, to increasing cardio, increasing mobility, or increasing work capacity, or getting a bit leaner, just something like that. Just to change focus and make sure that they're still motivated to train properly. Otherwise, it just dwindles, turns to shit, and they just exit, and they just feel bad about the whole scenario. So that was really, really important. Another one was with a client that I had for quite a few years. His technique was never really like close to where I wanted it to be, and I would often send him reviews and say, you need to change this, you need to change this. And then a year later, the same problems would still exist. So then I thought to myself, I wonder where the gap is here, where the dissonance is. So I was like, okay, we're gonna do some feedback ratings each week, where each of my clients is gonna tell me if they think that their technique was good. So I got a rating out of 5, 5 being excellent, 0 being terrible, essentially. And so every client now tells me how good their technique was in their opinion. So I review that and then make adjustments, or say, why do you think your technique was only 3 out of 5? It looked like 5, for example. So this particular client rated 4 or 5 out of 5 every week when I thought it was about a 2.
Yeah.
So I found out that was the reason why I wasn't making changes. He just didn't think that he needed to.
Yeah.
So through communicating better like that, we got to the problem and solved it eventually. So, and
that communication piece, if you look at any profession in the world, the top earners in any profession are the best communicators and the most charismatic. So that stands true for medical professions, lawyers, personal trainers and coaches. It's just a symptom of great communication. Is you tend to engage people better, you tend to influence them better, you get better results, and you're better at inspiring people to work with you. And you know, I've talked to you guys about this before. When you've got this idea in your head of what you think you want to happen, and you communicate that verbally to someone, and you think, okay, these words are sinking in, and you're watching them nod and say, yeah, yep. The only true way for you to be sure that they understand that is to get them to repeat it back. So that's a technique that I learned from a book called The 1 Minute Manager. And so if you give someone a job, you got to say at the end of it, okay, so that I'm clear, that you're clear, tell me what a good job looks like here. Without that, it's just open to interpretation, and 2, 4, 6 weeks later, there's a whole missed opportunity.
That's exactly right. So like I would end up in the scenario, I'm still getting paid, he's still getting stronger, but I'm just frustrated because I like the problem solving aspect of coaching. So I can't solve that problem. Still, it's less fulfilling to me, I guess. So from both ends, that can affect things, I think, just that communication line.
Yeah, and it's quite often at the root of many conflicts and fallouts, you know. I've definitely had points of conflict where you sort of get back to the table. It's like, all right, let's work this out. And one person goes, well, I thought this. And the other person's like, oh, actually, I thought this. And it's usually just that there's an unspoken element to the conversation where you're both thinking different things. And there wasn't anyone who was necessarily wrong. It's just your perception didn't overlap.
Yeah, exactly right.
And usually like a communication point, someone might be losing interest in something because they haven't had that communication and you're not on the same sort of wavelength. And as soon as you revisit that by communicating, then you're both like, oh, okay, we're not thinking we're going in the same direction. What's happening? What do you need? What do you need to change? And like, as long as you communicate, for some people it might be weekly, for other people it might be literally after every session and daily.
Yeah.
You're always on that same projection towards the goals that you both want. So.
Totally. Totally.
I think the DISC profile, for me anyway, played a massive part in more effective communication with people.
Yeah.
When we did that course with Rod.
Yeah.
DISC profiling.
For anyone who doesn't know what DISC profile is, listen to episode 3 of the podcast where we do a whole episode on it. But the DISC profile, just a quick breakdown, is a personality profiling system which helps you understand, you know, whether somebody's a detail-orientated person, or if they're big picture, if they're a fast decision maker or a slow decision maker, or if they're more outcome orientated or people orientated.
Yeah, that's the big one, the outcome versus the people focus. So D for dominance, I for influence, S for steadiness, C for conscientiousness. And some people want details, others just want it short and sweet. Some people want to chat between sets, for example, about their life. There might be an S. Other people want to get on with it. They're probably a D. Other people want to know exactly why they're doing things. They might be a C. Or someone else might want to know, what's in it for me? What's it going to do for me? They're probably going to be an I. How's this going to improve me?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, very true. Jace, what was your first point, mate?
Well, that leads us pretty much into my first point. The whole DISC profiling is a way of kind of being more aware of a client's personality, kind of what makes them tick, essentially. So what motivators can you use to get the best out of the client? And once you know that and understand it, you might not do a test that actually tells you exactly, but if you understand it yourself, you're going to have a better, understanding of the system in a whole, and you can kind of like have a pretty accurate guess on what clients need from you, from a personality and just a person. And then understanding that is different for everyone. So you're kind of wearing all these different personality caps for different people, solely just to get the best out of them in a session. That was probably the biggest lesson in the way of people that I learned. Like, fair enough, people, you know, from a training perspective, people want to, you know, get better at their chosen discipline, I guess. But to get those best results and to kind of like be a better coach, you really need to understand the things that makes them tick.
Yeah.
Like, that's a big, big part of it.
And I've talked to you guys all about this at different points, and it's understanding that people will tell you goals, what their goals are. Sometimes that is their goals, but other times there's an ulterior motive below that. Jono, we've talked about this a lot. So somebody might come to you and say, hey, I want to lose 10 kilos. Yet there's a continuity in their behavior which says otherwise. And sometimes it's just that they want to do personal training because they enjoy the company. Sometimes they want to do it because they know exercising safely and effectively is good for them. And the actual goal, the stated goal, is not the goal. They don't care that much for it. And so learning how to sort of work past that lip service that you might get at the start, find out what really drives them, what they really value and what they're really aligned with, helps you then have a level of synergy with them when you're working with them. So it's not like this, this friction point where you're like, well, they want to lose 10 kilos and so you're giving them a hard time over not following their meal plan on the weekend versus being okay with the fact they haven't followed their meal plan because they actually just want to hang out with you.
Yeah, that's it. I think that's been a massive game changer for me is the what people say means nothing, what they do means everything, and it's normally a couple of weeks into their program where you can kind of pick out, okay, are they here to feel better? Are they here for an aesthetic goal or are they here just for the experience?
Yeah, totally. And that ties into my first point, which is every session needs to be an experience that exceeds the dollars invested. And so a really, really, really good personal trainer or coach, they're not just good at prescribing exercises and structuring the workout and checking form. What they really are is masters of understanding people. And so working out what that person's actually there for and then switching from session to session to be able to deliver that. And I mean, even in a team training session, that's something I try to do if I'm taking team training. So I might have a group of 15 people and I've got, three or four absolute alphas in there who need to be pushed and need to be challenged and need progressions from what's programmed. And then I might have a 50-year-old mum in there who's just looking to get back into exercise after spending the last 10 years raising her kids and not doing a lot. And so who I need to be for each of those people in that session is very, very different, so that when they do walk out the door and they think about how that session was, there's no questioning of it. But you can't be the same person to all those people to achieve that.
Totally agree with that. I've had clients, like if I have like four or five Skype consults in a row, I'll have one client who only wants to talk about what their training's been like and nutrition, and that's probably what I would be like. And then 20 minutes later, I have someone who only wants to talk about how I've been going, with anything.
Yeah.
It's just so funny. And then I swap back again. I just have to completely recalibrate where my brain's at for it. Because if I was them, I would be wanting like maximum productivity out of that session with coach because I'm paying for it, kind of thing.
And what are you on the DISC profile, Jeremy? What's your highest quality?
DC.
DC, yeah. So you're very outcome orientated.
Yeah, definitely.
You don't care about someone's dog.
No. And then they care about my dog, though.
Yeah.
Have a dog, but anyway. And I just thought that was just so interesting because I just have to change completely. I'm like, I'm being paid for this right now. That's funny. Oh, okay. And now I'm just used to it in some context. Like,
yeah.
We'll get the job done when we need to, but otherwise it's just a lot of shit talking in a lot of ways.
Well, it's funny you say that. I remember when I first started PTing back in the mid-2000s, I remember at one point feeling guilty. I was like, oh my God, people are paying me to just be their friend. And I struggled with that originally because I felt bad. It was one client in particular. I just couldn't get him to work hard, but he was doing two sessions a week with me, which was, $250 15 years ago, and I was thinking, this doesn't feel good to me. I'm not giving a lot of value, but the value I was considering there was what I would consider value. So if I went for two training sessions, I wanted to be work. This guy wanted connection more than anything. So he would have been high S on the DISC profile, or somebody whose highest value was connection. And so he was getting his needs met. It was just that I couldn't see the difference in the needs that people have.
That's where it's like understanding initial motivators for someone and kind of digging deep to start with is so important, because if you just assume, like for instance, someone wants to lose 10 kilos, it's like if you're not, if you haven't done it before, you kind of think, oh, well, that's what they want to do. But really, there's an underlying fact, and if you don't know the questions to ask or what signs to look for, then you're just completely off page with the person, but they think they know what that is, but you've got to dig deeper and ask the right questions.
Yeah.
And it's like something that you have to learn and spend a lot of time doing, because you just become a better, not only a better coach, but just someone that they trust. Like, and that's a big thing, is having that trust factor involved as well.
And how good is it though, once you realize everyone's got different needs that they're trying to have met.
Mm.
When it's not you getting your needs met by getting people jacked and strong, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, actually, for some of these people, there's actually no pressure for me to get results.
Yeah.
Because they're cool with coming in and, you know, having a moderately intense workout and sweating a bit and having a laugh and a high five, although we don't high five anymore because of the high virus. High elbow. It takes a lot of pressure off you as the trainer too. I know I felt a lot of pressure in the early days because if somebody wasn't making good progress, I felt like I was failing in my job.
I think what I always go into is I, as a trainer and as someone who likes to train really hard and be sort of left feeling quite exhausted after a session, I go in with any new client going, this person wants to be trained hard.
Yeah.
And then I do the personality thing and find out exactly what motivates them, what they need, and then adjust to that. But always in my head, I'm like, train this person as hard as you can. Like, basically, everyone's on the same page, and then you learn about them on the way.
And if
I take that sort of protocol, I know that I'm doing what I want to do, which is train people hard. So that makes me happy, but then also trying to make them happy and make them have a good session by figuring out what exactly they need along the way. And that's kind of like a good little baseline to start at, and then you adjust for each client that you get. So
yeah. And your primary quality on the disc profile is S?
I think we're high I. I think I was massively high I.
Okay.
Like,
okay.
I would have said there's I in there somewhere.
Yeah.
It's funny, I gave someone, probably the second time I've given someone the disc profiling to actually do, because they were interested rather than me just guessing. And I like hit the nail on the head with everything, and it just comes from repetition and practice. Like, you can look at someone like, you have these qualities, and if you know the profiling, you can pretty much get it spot on every time. But yeah, no one ever guesses mine. Like, I don't know if I'm just this flat line character or
chameleon. Chameleon, you adjust.
Massive.
Yeah.
If you tell me to do six sets of something, I'm like, and I get the three of it enough, don't care. I don't need to finish the job and go. I
mean, something new and exciting.
Give me something.
Wow. I thought you'd just get it done. Which would be a D. That would be a D trainer.
Right? DC. Yeah. Well, a D, you don't tell them what to do. They're doing their own thing. Yeah. They're doing their work. They're doing their own workout.
Yeah.
C will get it all done.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Totally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And an S will need you to give a bit of moral support.
And I find having C quality clients, I find hard because we clash. And I'm like, you know what? I've programmed four sets of this. We're adding another set. We're adding more volume this week, but we don't have time for this. So we're just going to move on. And they're like, no. You said four. We're doing four. And I'm like,
be flexible.
I find S the hardest. It's like talking in between sets, going at their pace. And there'll be some days where they're more interested in talking about life or something like that, rather than, you know, I've always got that outcome-focused mentality in the back of my mind. And it's like when I first started coaching, it was just tearing my hair out. I was like, why the fuck aren't these people doing what I'm asked them to do? And then just through that understanding now, it's like, okay, what do they actually need and what do they actually want? Mm-hmm. Got to give them a bit of both.
Yeah.
Definitely, you've got to draw the line somewhere, and they've got to get it done somehow, or at least a minimum amount.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I think I have a few clients where I could just pretty much talk shit the whole session, do two sets, and we'll be good. And they wouldn't question it.
Yeah.
Can't just do that. You know?
No. There's certainly got to be an element of principles that we stick to.
Mm-hmm.
Jono, what was your first point?
Look, Jason and Jeremy basically covered it, but connection and understanding the real why. Are they there to feel better? Which a lot of people are, and that's cool. Are they there for the experience, or are they there for aesthetic goals? So I have, like, if someone tells me they want to lose weight or lose a certain body fat percentage or change their body, I have a buy-in agreement.
Mm.
We sit down with each other and go over that, and it's like a signed agreement. It's legit. They look over that, sign and date it, and we look at that every 8 weeks. We decide, okay, what's going on here? Have goals changed or whatever?
Mm.
And that seems to work. And the ones that don't sign that at the start, we know what it gives me a tool to understand. Okay, you're here for the experience, or you're here to feel better. That's fine. So we get off on the right foot.
Yeah.
I think a big one is like building emotional fitness as well, self awareness, and getting a greater understanding, looking past the superficial. Why do you really want to do this?
Mm.
That's been something that I've really focused on. That's helped my clients a lot. And Yeah, I think the big one for me since I started is within connection and understanding is just moving away from just being an outcome focused and accommodating for the people focused as well.
Yeah.
I think with general population, it's way more important to include those things because, you know, at the end of the day, they're just looking to improve their quality of life, and emotional fitness is so important.
Yeah.
And even though that's not our title, is to be, you know, an emotional fitness coach or to help someone get through, you know, their dog passing away or something like that. It's like you develop those qualities because you're there to make their session better. So you sort of like, you practice those things without really knowing that's what you're signing up for.
It also helps them with their habits as well, like within the context of their goals. Correct. If they're more emotionally aware, then it directly helps with those two.
Yeah.
Have you guys listened to my episode with Rachel and David Godfrey on emotional fitness?
Yeah, you only shared it recently and I'm probably three quarters of the way through and it's interesting.
Yeah.
Especially hearing similar things, but someone saying it in a different way.
Yeah.
And then it kind of like sticks with you a little bit better.
Those two are brilliant. They're mm-hmm. so good at what they do. And, you know, they work with primarily really successful people who have been hugely successful in their career. And in Rachel's words, can't get their shit together with food and exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk about how most people don't need another training and nutrition strategy. They need to learn how to stick to the one they started.
Yeah.
And it's so bloody true, you know. Mm. It's so true. And that emotional fitness piece really is just who do you become? And this ties into the disc profile stuff as well. Because with the disc profile test, it'll test your primary profile, but also who you become under stress. And so who people become under stress is a reflection of their emotional fitness. You know, a lot of people become extremely unstructured and undisciplined under stress because they're then looking to outsource their feelings to some other agency, whether it be food, alcohol, drugs, whatever it is. But that conversation I had with Rachel and David is just a phenomenal insight into the underlying meta program that everybody runs on and what they need to really work on to be able to actually stick to the stuff that we do.
And just going back into like general, someone starting a new program, something that is like almost detrimental to their fitness goals is how much they chop and change something.
Mm.
But you can have the most basic of programs, and if you stick to it and do it correctly, you are going to see results. But people think that you have to change and do this and do that. But there's probably, whether it's a personality profile, which is making you change, or it's like you see something new and you have that personality type again to be like, oh, I need to do this, I need to do this, I need to do this. So you're not sticking to something. Mm. Which is another very important thing, which comes down to you as that sort of coach being like, is there anything I can help with? Is there any underlying issues? Or asking questions that they kind of give you an example of something that you've done before. Like I always try to, I love using analogies in things, but then I also like using analogies in the way of like trying to find answers to questions.
Yeah.
Just a bit of eye on port over the back here.
Well, look, weight loss, the best description of this I've heard, weight loss is a behavior driven goal.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're not helping them with their behaviors,
yeah,
then they're not gonna lose weight.
Yeah, and people, I think it's really important for anyone who is currently overweight to understand is you are not fat, you've just been doing fat things.
Yeah, huge.
And so you've been doing more of those things than you've been doing lean things. And so when you can replace the fat things with the lean things, the body comp will take care of itself.
Absolutely.
You've just got to do it enough and for long enough.
Yeah, it's who you become in the process of that transformation.
And they're pretty, it's pretty, you know, through the process of doing it, it should become just second nature is not the right term. It should become pretty nondescript. Like doing lean things, it's just, you know, walking where you could have driven. It's daily movement practice.
Not drinking that second glass of port.
Well, you know.
Not sitting down.
I'm all right with the port bit. But it's they're pretty, you know, it's pretty subtle changes, right?
They just become habitual.
Yeah.
You don't need to think about them or spend any effort doing those kind of things. Just like going for a walk or parking ages away so you can walk into town. You think about it just in terms of saving money, maybe. You don't care about the fitness effort that you have to do to walk up a hill to go back to your car after work kind of thing. It just becomes second nature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even, you know, outside, I mean, those are the outside of training things. I mean, the one of the really common conversations I've had with people, especially people who have maybe come to our gym who've been trying something else, and it's just that discovery conversation. So I spoke with a customer this week who said, you know, I've been training for 4 years and I've been, you know, on meal plans and I just struggle to lose body fat. And I was like, okay, what's going on here? And so just asking questions. Okay, what training have you been doing? Tell me about the food. The food was really good.
Mm-hmm.
And so eventually I got to a point where I was like, all right, tell me about work. And she goes, oh, well, you know, I work remotely. I even worked remotely before COVID. And I just sit on the couch all day on my laptop. I was like, okay, here we go.
Mm-hmm.
So do you track your steps? No, but I basically go to the gym and go home and sit on the couch on my laptop all day. So there's some pretty low-hanging fruit there all of a sudden for helping this person get through that next bit of progress. And it doesn't involve changing anything except, hey, turn on your step count on your phone and get 10,000 a day for me.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Massive.
It's one of those
huge things. And it's even just like a tiny little thing that's just like a reminder that they might even know, like, the fundamentals of weight loss is quite simple.
Very.
Eat less, move more.
Mm.
Basically, like, obviously it comes with food quality and exercise choice and all that sort of stuff, but the basics and the fundamentals of it.
Mm.
But it's just hard because people struggle with the consistency thing.
Mm.
Doing it every day. All I tell my clients is just try and eat as well as you possibly can, standard this caloric intake if you want to lose weight, and move.
Mm.
And do something hard every day in the gym with me.
Mm.
And it's like, if you stick to those three things, and you do them consistently on a daily basis,
mm.
you will get there.
Mm.
It's just always just reminding them.
It's about trying to build that habit as well, rather than just using like things to tick off the list.
Yes.
As well. Yep. Because if you just say, like the steps example, I think it's a good example to get started. But eventually if someone has to walk 15,000 steps per day or
yeah.
whatever,
yeah.
they might just see it as something to get done and it doesn't get built in as a habit very
yeah.
effectively, because it's just like another chore in a sense.
Definitely. And if it's getting up to 15,
yeah.
why are we needing to do 15? And if they're actually doing 15,000 a day and not seeing the rate of progress or the kind of results they're wanting to see, that's when we've got to ask more questions. Okay,
yeah.
you're training each day, you're doing 15,000 steps, you're not losing weight, what else is going on here? And so that's where that questioning and the skillful questioning goes to advanced skillful questioning is, what else is going on here that's not being spoken? And maybe it's 3 bottles of wine on the weekend. Maybe it's a night eating disorder. Who knows what it is,
yeah.
but there starts to become all these other things.
It's all about digging deep in those scenarios.
Yeah.
There's actually a lot of research, nutritional research on long-term fat loss
yeah.
in obese individuals. And at the end of their fat loss phase, about 50 to 70% of people will underreport how much food they're eating.
Yeah, I've read that
without even knowing.
Yeah.
Without even intentionally lying to you.
Yeah.
So it can become a really tricky point.
Yeah, people are terrible at tracking.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make them bad people. It's just hard.
Yeah.
It's a hard thing to get good at if you're not from this world and if you haven't practiced it for a long time. So, you know, it's without being able to see everything they're doing, it's really hard to keep tabs on that. But I think it's fair to assume, you know, if you've got a male client who's reporting that they're eating 2,500 to 3,000 calories a day, they're doing 15,000 steps, they're doing 6 training sessions, and the weight's going nowhere, it's probably fair to assume that the calorie reporting is incorrect.
Probably. And then, I mean, right. from there, it doesn't matter. You can just drop it down to 2,000
yeah.
to 2,500. And if they're actually eating 2,700, oh, well, it doesn't matter. If they're still not losing it, just drop it down again. At least that 27 will eventually go to 23.
The number is arbitrary,
exactly,
isn't it?
Exactly. Even if you're prescribing 1,800, it'll be dropping down. So you can just find where the balance needs to be. It's tricky with like lighter females, or I guess sedentary females that don't really burn a lot of energy.
Mm.
If they're down at like 1,200 or 1,300, then where do you go from there? You can't really keep chopping it off. So you have to dig a bit deeper with some of the questions, I think.
Yeah.
See if they're under-reporting.
For sure. Very challenging. All right, Jerome, what's your second of the top three, so my in no particular order.
My second topic was something that I overrated to start with. It was technique needs to be immaculate all of the time, or at least 95% good all of the time, kind of thing, or like really close to perfect. So that's not true. Like, it doesn't need to be perfect all the time for a powerlifter coming into competition. Even it can actually inhibit you, because you won't add weight to the bar. You might become a technique Nazi and just inhibit long-term progression by focusing on such small details with technique. And with injuries and technique, injuries are actually more predicted based on overall workload compared to what you're used to. So for an example, coming out of a competition, if you go into 10x10s or 8x8s or something like that, and you're not used to that volume because you've just been peaking for a meet, you're more likely to get injured then than if you did a 100 max in the gym or something and your back rounded quite a lot. Like, no one gets injured at competition, like next to no one, compared to in training.
Fatigue-driven injuries.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Most injuries tend to be like that. It's
except that guy I saw at the Arnold's tear both quads simultaneously.
There's that. With knee wraps and with the untested lifters, there's a few more factors in there, and they get more injured more frequently in competition. But like, for natties and with sleeves on, like, you never see injuries at comp. It just doesn't happen. Maybe if someone's benching 250, they might tear a pec once in a while. But like, I honestly don't even remember a competition that I've seen someone injure their back, even though 80% of lifters will have a flexed spine during like a 100 max airlift.
They've earned the right.
That may be it, yeah. And also, just because fatigue is so low at that point, probably a bit safer at that point.
That makes total sense, man.
And the body actually adapts to imperfect technique.
That's right.
I'm not saying you should have shitty technique, but you might not need to worry about it as much.
Well, Mark Buckley taught me the principle of non-conformist lifting a decade ago, and he said when you're dealing with anyone who has to express their strength in a sporting situation that's uncontrolled or reactive, you need to have done some non-conformist lifting. So it's deadlifting with a round back, deadlifting in an offset stance, even up to doing squats with your feet on different levels. Because this is what plays out on a football field or a rugby field. You know, you're going to have to express your strength from these different positions. And he talked a lot about competition lifts and, when people do things with imperfect technique, that, you know, things are going to go amiss, but the hours or the thousands of reps you've done well, and then the last couple here and there tend to prepare you for those imperfect executions. But one of the most profound things I ever heard anyone say was an Ido Portal video, and he said, look, injury is the domain of specialization. You look at any sport, whether it be marathon running, powerlifting, gymnastics, everyone has injuries. And so it becomes a game of skill versus injury management. And that's a really good lesson for general pop, because it's like, okay, what are we going to do to keep this person moving every day without them getting injured? And so one of the principles I apply to team training, which is a general pop program, is vector variability. So moving through as many different patterns as possible, and counter function training, so strengthening control centers of the body so that they can move through those vectors with a maximum level of control.
Dan, one of the key things that you mentioned a few months ago, I remember, was the key trainable quality for an athlete is availability.
Yes.
Above all else.
Yes, it's the most important ability, availability. You're not much good if you're injured.
That's it. That's all so important for long-term strength progression as well. If you get someone out for 3 months or whatever and they've got a niggly back forever now, you can kind of be screwed in long-term progression, or at least maximizing it. Larry puts his hand up. It's all about injury management. Not pushing the envelope too much with volume intensity to start.
Have you found with a lot of your clients, like the maximum MVP, the maximum MRV, varies depending on genetics?
Definitely. It's hugely genetic. It's also a little bit body weight dependent and maximal strength dependent. So if you have a lightweight female who moves through small ranges of motion who's pretty weak, they can generally do a lot more sets.
More slow twitch fibers, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that'll play into it.
Less absolute load.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And total ROM is a huge one as well.
Yep. Yep.
And then age is huge too. 20-year-olds will be able to tolerate way more volume overall than like 40-year-old or even 35-year-old.
Yep. I mean, that book, I'm getting to notice that I would do a lot of volume in my early 20s, but now I'm
getting old
towards
now.
The end of that. I'm like, jeez, can't see it.
Mate, I've noticed the difference from 30 to 40. That's the worst. Like, seriously, I used to... I remember when I was finishing off football. So I finished playing football when I was 28 or 29. I remember in my early 20s hearing guys who were towards the end of their 20s talking about how you slow down. I thought, yeah, righto. And then I remember when I was, like, training, just lifting in my early 30s, hearing people talk about, oh, well, when you're 40, I just think, fucking righto. It's a real thing.
Yeah.
Like, I've got way less juice for training these days than what I've ever had. And so you learn to become really selective with what you do.
Mm.
You choose the stuff that has the highest reward on your time and the least risk.
Yeah, massive. I used to do 20 to 24, I used to do multiple hours a day and just handle it well and recover, come back tomorrow. Handle well, recover, come back tomorrow. Now I'm like, if I do a couple of sessions in a day, where it might be one session, but I've broken it up into two sessions and then add a little bit of extra accessory work to that, I'm beat up and I'm just like, this is not how I should be training. It's like doing too much. I can't handle what I used to be able to handle. And yeah, as you get older and I guess your training age increases, you feel like, oh, I can handle more, but really you get older, so you just can't. So you gotta focus on way more rewarding movements and stuff that's gonna give you way more reward than it is risk.
I think overdoing. Adding to that, spending a bit more time on like working in rather than working out, like mobility and looking after your body is a lot more. Like when you're 20, you can just get up and train with a hangover if you want, and it's like water off a duck's back. But now it's a lot harder. You have to look after your body more.
You still train with a hangover though, wouldn't you?
I still train with a hangover.
Good like that. Very reliable. But the working in is a good one. I was talking about that concept with a client this week who he was saying, you know, if I train 5 days in a row, I'm just cooked all weekend. He said, but I've noticed if I have Thursdays off, I'm a lot better. So train Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday. I said, you know, Thursday, work in. And this is a guy who has a teenage son who's a cycling prodigy. And so they've got the whole cycle studio set up at home. I said, get on the bike and do a 20-minute ride instead of coming into the gym and getting your ass handed to you. Just do like a 20-minute ride or do some yoga off YouTube. And so it's not do nothing, it's do something. Do something that gets your heart rate up and gets your respiration rate up, but doesn't take a lot from you. So your net recovery is in the positive for that day. You're not depleted again. Big one. Jace, what was your second point there, mate?
Second point. This is more about a trainer or coach who is not sport specific. So like, for instance, Jeremy being a powerlifting coach, someone who is just a general fitness trainer.
Jeremy's a unicorn. He's a unicorn. There's not many personal trainers who are actually doing a specific niche only.
No. And it's harder. It's a lot harder because obviously you're attracting attracting someone towards one thing only. But it's good. It's like good to build a community in that thing, though.
Well, I think the really important point on that from a business perspective. I've known a lot of trainers over the last 20 years, 16 years that I've been in this industry. Very few manage to get to the point where they work with niche clients only. Very, very few. And it's great if you could get there. It's a great ambition, but don't feel like a failure if you don't.
And that's my point. My point is being as broad as you possibly can in your learning. Learning as much as you possibly can in the banner of health and fitness.
Yeah.
So learning, spending a period of time yourself training as a powerlifter, spending a period of yourself training just for hypertrophy and aesthetics, spending a period of time just trying to be, you know, as conditioned as possible, working on solely aerobic fitness and then different energy systems. And even if you don't do it yourself, trying to study that and just learn learn a little bit about a lot, kind of like.
But it's good if you do it yourself too, because you can be this jack dude who can outlift strong. People who are trying to be powerlifters and outrun them and outfight them. Like, you do everything you can, just pull an alpha move whenever you need to.
And you look jacked as
that's important, right?
Very important.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where the volume thing is starting to become a bit of an issue. You just can't do all that anymore. So, but that's probably my I love it too. Like, if someone comes to me and they, for instance, I have a client at the moment who I'm just doing some basic boxing training with, and because I've done bits of it before, I feel like I can give them what they need. They're just using boxing as their conditioning for the week, and because I've learnt that as a skill, I'm able to acquire that client and give them what they need. So learning different, lots of different things in that health and fitness band is important, I think.
I think that was even important for me as a unicorn during the COVID situation. As I said before, like, with everyone's situation changing, I was doing a lot of like relearning of a lot of different stuff, like different energy system based stuff, like back to the uni days. And spent hours doing that just so I could recustomize everything to make it so it was still actually like a good training plan, essentially.
Yeah.
So that kind of hit me for
and trust and work and working that new knowledge into something that you already know is going to help when you get back in the gym and you start lifting again. And yeah, I think everything that you learn should have a I know, especially if it's like sports specific, whatever you learn, you should be able to customize it towards that program to make it best fit in. Like, for instance, with myself at the moment, because I'm about to enter a powerlifting comp.
Whoa!
Wow. Oh,
that's not commitment.
Whoa!
Oh, commitment.
Episode, big words from a little man.
Episode 19.
Recorded commitment.
That's right.
Got to hold him to that now.
So I'm
hold him to that.
Let's switch from the port to the champagne, shall we?
So I'm doing way less conditioning work in the way of.
Heard it here first.
A lot of metabolic stress and leaving myself feeling just ruined to just conditioning for aesthetics, really. So just like keeping my heart rate up, keeping healthy, but just more steady state, longer stuff.
Let's talk openers. Let's talk openers. What do you reckon, coach? Opener for Jason. He's surely easy, coach.
Well, who's that? What's it going
to
be?
Love to be. Love to be.
Okay, so openers, what do we reckon?
Squat.
220 squat.
195.
You squatted 200. I've seen you squat 200.
Yeah, I'm not an opener. This
is hard. I barely know that well. But bench, I don't know. Have you benched in the last year?
Yeah.
What do you reckon?
So we did a 3RM test we passed on Wednesday, actually. And I was 115 for 5.
Oof.
All
right. 123.
Yeah, 123. Nice. Dead
with
1,000
sumo, surely.
100%.
Yeah.
Cheating every day of the week.
That's it.
Gets
you the win,
man. I'd open with probably 220, 240. Yeah.
What body weight?
86 at the moment, so I don't know what.
Pretty good.
Gotta be 85.
Easy.
Yeah. Under 85.
Solid as.
Yeah. All right, it's pretty solid. Okay, continue on.
Is there a reason why those numbers have been jotted down there?
Just wanted to double down on the commitment there. Yeah. Put it out there now.
It's
happening. What were we talking about?
Learning energy systems different methods of training in the fitness and health and better.
Being an all-rounder.
Being an all-rounder, yeah.
And I think that's important. Like, if you go to a doctor and you're like, you know, I'm having a heart attack at the moment. They go, oh, I don't do heart stuff. I only do broken bones. Bit of a problem, yeah?
I think
a personal trainer should... I think it's not unreasonable to expect personal trainers should be competent in many different training methods.
And there's no reason why you can't have a field that is of higher interest to you, because everyone does.
Yeah.
But it's just knowing a little bit about a lot of different things helps you have a better understanding. The one thing that I've been spending some time with some other coaches that are specialists, they seem to have a one-way only approach.
Mm.
Like, there's only one way to do something. There's only one way to get stronger. There's only one way to be more jacked. There's only one way to be fitter.
Mm.
But like the saying goes, there's many ways you can skin a cat. And it's like, I'm very science-based with my evidence, so, and there's lots of different ways to do something.
Yeah.
And as long as you're, as long as you have some proven theories behind it, you can test and try different things and use yourself, like I do a majority with my training, like figure out different ways to be better in something, but it's kind of like not as, what's the word? Like, it's just not as common. Just another way to do something, like, like, for instance, I have a client who doesn't like doing bodybuilding stuff, but I'm trying to make them put on some muscle mass, but we do it in a more functional way. So it's not the usual style of training, but you know your sets, reps, and volume is going to be the same as what a traditional bodybuilding or hypertrophy program would be, but it's just a different way of doing it. So it's, it's just understanding those basic elements, which will help you take a long way in your coaching career.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I've sort of dived into just about everything over the last 15 years or so. You know, for, I started off doing a lot of stuff on energy system work early in my career. Even to the point of reading the CrossFit Journal, forgive me. Lots of stuff on, you know, strength and conditioning, strength development, power. I mean, my number one sort of, I suppose, motivating factor for exercise is just how it makes me feel.
Yeah,
so I'm not too attached to any one method. And I found the whole lockdown period pretty easy, even though I could have gone into the gym. I think I trained in the gym a maximum of 5 times in that 11 weeks. Could have been in there every day, but I had kettlebells at home and I had running shoes. So I sort of, I used kettlebells and went running and just used it as an opportunity to do non-gym stuff.
Well, there's a period of training for you that you spoke about where you just did kettlebell training. A few years ago, you were just doing lifting, ballistic movements just with kettlebells.
Yeah.
And it is like, if you do it correctly and you have a program and you follow it, you get a lot of good training results out of just following a kettlebell on your program or something of that nature.
Well, being at home for 11 weeks and not really going into the gym, a lot of the niggles that I've been carrying for a long time just disappeared. I find I've got a really bad back that I've have for a long time, and one of the things I find is kettlebell swings are like the most therapeutic exercise I can do for it. The nature of that lift just is really restorative for my back. It tends to train all the important muscles without putting any deleterious compressive forces on the lumbar spine. Yeah,
especially with the amount of control you need with a kettlebell, depending if you're swinging it or pressing it above your head. Like if you do something slightly incorrectly, excuse me, with a barbell it's least forgiving, but with a kettlebell that thing goes out of the frontal plane even slightly, you really got to get tight and control that. So it's
it teaches you to control the weight really well. I'd golfer's elbow in both elbows as well, and by the end of that lockdown they were totally gone because I'd done so much kettlebell pressing, which requires a lot of good rotator cuff activation. I came back from that lockdown feeling better than I have in a long time, and that sort of goes back to just having many methods to draw upon, and you know, necessity forcing you to go back to some things. And they're definitely skill sets and knowledge sets that you definitely lose them. I mean, I was talking to you once, Jeremy. I mean, I was a better trainer 5 years ago. I've got no problem saying that. I was a much better trainer when I was reading and implementing every day and training clients every day. The nature of my existence now is becoming more and more focused on the business and developing people, and I suppose leveraging that base skill set into developing other people to do my bidding, if it were. But, you know, I can go back to any of these things I've learned, done a refresher, and very quickly sort of go, oh, that's right, that's why this was so good, and I can go and use it again. And you sort of retain 60, 70% of it, and you just top up again.
The knowledge won't be lost. It's just kind of hidden. And then once you reread things, it'll just spring back up like pretty easily.
That's right.
If I went back through some of my old uni notes that are like pretty heavy notes, but if I reread through something that would have taken me 10 hours to learn, I could probably relearn it in 2 hours, even though it was so long ago. It's just, those pathways are still up there somewhere.
The folder's on the computer. You just got to click on it, open it up, and reread it.
If it's anything like your desktop.
The desktop's pretty messy, mate.
Don't worry about that, mate. It's organised chaos. There's a lot going on. All right, my second point was understanding the real motivator will allow you to serve, lead, and inspire people at a much higher level. You know, it's a funny thing, this life. This is something I've had a really good grasp on with clients, but in recent times I've had to relearn that lesson with people who work in my organization. And so we've had a few people leave over the last couple of months, and I've got no problem talking about it. A lot of those departures were my fault because I wasn't applying that point with the people who worked in my organization, and I was aligning the way their workday looked with how I value my workday. And so I'd set up a structure where there was a great opportunity for autonomy and the ability to earn, when a lot of these people actually needed support, connection, and to feel safe. And so that's a really interesting point, that whilst we've covered it here from a client perspective, it's just funny from a philosophical point of view, when you sort of see these things from a different angle and you're like, oh, I knew that, but still I overlooked it in this context.
It's because it's just, I guess it's just not a natural thing if it's not practiced regularly, or if you don't reread it or re-look at the topic itself, you just sort of do, and you think, and you just have this process of like, I feel like what we were talking about at the very start, it's like, if you don't revisit or communicate, you don't know.
Mm.
You don't know what people want, or you don't know what people need. So it needs to be something that's like, you know, revisited daily, weekly, at a time that, you know, best suits both of you.
And you can be really good at something in one part of your life and totally overlook it in another.
Mm-hmm.
You see this all the time. People can be really good at communicating in their business but terrible in their relationships.
Yeah.
Or vice versa. Yeah. So it's funny how these principles permeate throughout. Jono, what was your second point, mate?
Second point was related to something that you taught me, principle of maximum activity, but I just tweaked that and called it principle of maximum value.
Yeah.
So just going above and beyond, doing all the little things, doing a lot more than what they could do on their own.
Mm.
Look, the program and the methods are really a secondary consideration. It's more about the experience they're getting and going above and beyond.
Yeah.
Really, that's really helped skyrocket my business, really.
Yeah, and those two are interrelated. Activity and value. And it doesn't have to be activity for activity's sake, but it's asking yourself that question, what else can we be doing here in this 60 minutes or 120 minutes of face-to-face contact each week? What else can we be doing here that would be of high value for this person and help move them towards their goals? So it might be, it might be a complimentary exercise, it might be the way you structure your sessions, it might be other things that you're teaching them between sets that are going to be of high value for them in moving forward with their goals. All right, Jeremy, let's go round three.
All right, my last lesson, or one of my other lessons, was that lifting can be so much more than just lifting in the physical sense. So there's so much to be gained through the community aspect of lifting, whether you're a powerlifter, bodybuilder, or just a team trainee, or even just a general gym goer. The community aspect is just so vital, I think, to long-term progression, and just something so useful in increasing adherence to the plan and into retaining clients, essentially, I reckon. So when I get a new client, like a new powerlifting client who wants to get stronger, they've already got decent technique, they want to do a comp, they're not extremely strong yet, but I don't think that matters for a first comp, I'll just try and throw them in the deep end, get them into a comp almost straight away, just to embed them in the community and just to improve motivation coming into that comp, and then they just tend to like training more with that community side of things, I reckon.
Mm-hmm.
So that was probably something that I underrated to start with again, but now, even for myself, for my own lifting or for my own enjoyment, like having a whole crew of lifters and friends that I like to train alongside, or like to coach, like to see progress, just increases the experience so much more. So if I'm having a bad training day, it's not as bad anymore, because it's not just about the progress like that.
Yeah.
It's about the other progress, like the community progress.
It's a big reason behind the success of CrossFit.
Yeah.
F45, shut it down the spine. It's the community aspect, you know. People like to do things together and they like to belong. So, yeah, certainly can't be undervalued.
I think a community aspect, even if the training itself isn't going fantastic, or the progression of the training isn't going fantastic, or even just like a relationship with a coach at that current point in time isn't fantastic, the community is like, I don't want to let these people down. I want to go back and hang out with them. If I'm no longer doing this thing, I lose that whole community. Like I've lost this chunk of my life that I've, you know, spent a lot. Like I'm there nearly every day. I'm spending a big part of my week, you know, with these people. And if I stop doing this, I lose that. Like, so that's another.
I think that's something that can make lifting just second nature and just a habit and require not much effort. Just having that as the backbone, because you don't think twice about it. You just go in there and lift. And if you didn't go in there, you'll just lose that community aspect. It's just so big for a human.
Come in and do some bench press and, you know, admire the training sweater of Mr. Hill.
That's right. Shout out Daniel fashion. Hill.
Daniel
the
Hill.
The most handsome man in Hobart Power.
So well dressed. So well dressed. Nice socks, nice sweater. School teacher.
Neat haircut.
Well mannered.
Huge pecs.
Huge pecs. Imagine getting that guy as your teacher.
Yeah.
That's me. Wowee.
You should hear some of the stories.
Yeah, I have.
Wowee.
Podcast 20.
Shout out to Bridgewater High. Anyway. Yeah, it's, look, it keeps people coming back. People want to belong more than anything. They want to belong.
Yeah.
Jason, a third point for you.
Third point is more of a sort of a personal thing, I guess. It's finding your why, I guess, like why are you doing something? And sort of sitting down with yourself and asking yourself, like, what gets me up? What keeps me going? It can be anything. It can be motivated by.
What gets you up?
What gets me up? To be honest, it is helping people. I mean, I have these conversations with people before and they're like, bullshit. It's not helping people. There's an underlying factor. I'm like, to tell the truth, if someone does something more than what they've done before, I'm happy. Like my first ever personal training client was in my carport, and it was just this old fella who wanted to lose some weight so he could play with his kid in the park. And in my head I'm like, that wasn't much for me, but we did 6 weeks of solid training, and then we sort of weren't getting the results. So it was like, I didn't know anything about personality, and I sort of sat down with him. I was like, what's going on? And it was, he had a very bad habit of eating food at night time. So it would get to the end of the day, everything was perfect, training wise, nutrition, but then he would indulge in very dense caloric foods because it was just a habit.
Doritos and custard,
everything, like
Doritos and custard.
Just cheese and cheese and pork. Yeah, everything. But then we did another 6 weeks after that, and he lost 20 kilos total across our 12 weeks. And he walked up to me and just hugged me and just like so emotional. Yeah. And I felt that, and I'm like, oh, this is what I'm going to do. This is what I'm going to do for a little while. I enjoy that feeling. So now when like if someone comes up to me and I've only spent a little bit with them, but I've helped them develop more confidence in walking into a room where there's people, sweet. That makes me feel good. So it's just like figuring out what your why is. Some people are massively motivated by money. And if people, we've had this conversation, and you make more money, it's not because you want to make more money, but you're making more money because you're doing a better job. So it all comes under that whole thing. Simon Sinek's books, the why? What's the name of the book?
Find Your Why.
Yeah. Read it 3 or 4 times, and I always go back to it when I'm a bit like, what am I doing it for? And then I ask myself the questions that they ask yourself, that they ask, get you to ask in the book, and it just like,
that's the golden circle principle, the why in the middle, how, and then the what on the outside.
Correct.
Yeah,
correct.
That's the one.
Correct.
Yeah, it's a good book, that.
And it's just for me, it's like when I was young, I was always like, I always wanted to be a professional footballer. And like everything that I did was leading towards that. And then all of a sudden it was like, it was just come to a halt. It was just dead stop. This is not you anymore. So I was like, shit, like what now? And asking myself that question, both with work and relationships and family and all those sorts of things, has really kind of set in stone the person I want to be as well, which then helps you as a coach, because you're actually doing something you want to do. If you're not happy in your profession, if you're not happy in a certain place, then you're never going to be able to give your best self. So I find it important to go around and ask yourself why am I doing this on a regular basis. It just brings home the reasons why you're doing it, and it can be for money, it can be because you want to make people happy, it can be because you want people to look at you better, it can be because you want to buy a brand new pair of $6,000 sneakers. Whatever the reason is,
sure, coach,
go for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's the most worthwhile thing you can do in your life. Yes. Is get clear on what your highest value is.
Mm-hmm.
We talked a little bit. You touched on the money thing there. I'm highly motivated by money because I have a really clear relationship with what money means to me,
mm-hmm.
and it's not because I don't have issues around money. I want to make money so I can have a better experience with my family. And yep. So my family, the love and connection of my family is my highest value. I put it above all else.
Mm-hmm.
And financial success is merely a vehicle for having better experiences with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I find it really easy to motivate myself to do a lot of work and get a lot of stuff done because that's the thing that's fueling that.
Yep. So you wake up in the morning, you're like, I'm going to go to work, I'm going to make more money.
Yeah.
So I can get to my highest value, which is giving my family better experiences and spending more time with them.
Yeah, and when I talk about the relationship with money, it's also a relationship that any business owner has to develop over time is the relationship between money and service.
Correct.
And so, you guys have all been first-hand observers of the standards that I hold for people who work in my organization. I have high standards in what I expect from staff and what I want to have happen because I understand that that's tied very closely to the level of service someone gets, which is tied to their experience, which is tied to how much they'll pay, how long they'll stay, how many people they refer. And so the whole thing comes back to service.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want to make more money, if you're in business and you want to make more money, you really just have to work out a way to show more value to more people.
Yes.
And that's the game.
Provide a better service.
Yeah, you don't wake up in the morning, open up a spreadsheet and think, okay, how do I make this thing do more money? It's mm-hmm. just, it's really looking at what problems people have, how we solve them,
mm-hmm.
and what sort of economic model you can apply to that.
Yeah.
The actual money side of it sort of takes care of itself once you've got those fundamentals in place.
Money's, I guess you can think of money like as a motivator, but it's similar to an individual athlete or sporting team. It's like, I want to win more trophies.
Yeah.
I want to, I want to go to certain competitions and do this, and this. It's like, it's the reward. It's like getting towards something. If I make this much money, I know I have sold X amount of units, or I know I have given this much service at this quality.
Yeah.
So it's like, it can just be a goal. Once I get there, I know I have achieved this, and then you can keep using that as a motivator.
I think just a natural organic thing is the value increases that you provide, then the more money you earn,
yeah.
basically.
Yeah.
And the learn, there's nothing wrong with that.
It's like a scorecard.
Yes. Yes.
That's where I value it, I think.
Totally. And where you see it play out too, I mean, when somebody has a really good relationship with money, they'll be really good at making money, but they'll be really generous with money as well.
Mm-hmm.
When people have, you quite often see high earners who have bad relationships with money, and that bad relationship will be that they put money above all else, they're not generous with their money, they're not generous with their time, and it's just all about money, and it's all about protecting and keeping and hoarding and holding. So you certainly see those iterations, but the scorecard analogy is a great one too.
Even just with money as the sole topic, we spoke literally a couple of hours ago about what motivates people to make money. You said you had a couple of friends who make a decent couple of $1 million salary a year, but the only reason why it's there is because they spend it like $200,000-$300,000 a month because they are motivated by poverty.
Yeah.
They're motivated by not having money, so when they don't have money, they make more money.
Yeah.
So they have this big bank account with savings in it, then it wouldn't motivate them to keep on making money.
Yeah, it was a couple I did business coaching with. So they had both come from, one of them in particular, really low socioeconomic background, and they were really motivated whenever they were broke.
Yeah.
So they found it easy to fire up when they were broke. And so they had this great business where... the wife was a really good marketer and the husband did sales, and they sold marketing and sales courses, and they would regularly go and spend everything they had because they
just to be back to zero.
Yeah, to be back to zero because they knew it brought the best out of them in their business. And Alana and I really struggled to resonate with that. We sort of saw that more like they're fucked up, but they were brilliant at what they did. They were so good at marketing and sales. It didn't resonate with us to go and spend every dollar you had to motivate you to go again.
Yeah.
You know,
they're playing to their strengths in a way like that.
Yeah.
Or they're spending it on.
But then
Versace, then you play, holidays, booze.
But then if they had taken, like, let's say they earn, $2 million a year, why don't they just take 10% of that, invest it, pretend like they never even made it?
Yeah.
That's the thing that,
they,
like,
they might have been, I'm not sure. They might have been doing that. But they
I guess
were
that
all
comes
about
just down to relationships with money as well. Like,
yeah,
it sounds like they're really tapping into like the fight or flight mode, and that gets the best out of you if you can do that.
And then it's a two-edged sword because you just spend all your money just to make more money, but then you're just spending it again to make more. But at most, like I'm exactly the same. You put $2,000 in my hand and say, invest it, or you know, go and buy some. And I'm, there's no way if I have to wait for that.
That's just
me, and I'm trying to be better with that.
You'd have some nice shoes and
socks. Yeah, I'm going
to
buy a full outfit, and with the extra $200, I'm just going to go buy a bottle of whiskey. And I'll sit there, and I'm like, oh shit! I got whiskey. I'm in a suit, but look,
you're good, right?
This is not going to make me any more money. I'm done now. Like, so it's just that relationship, and kind of, I guess, trying to better yourself with money.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Who's up? Is
you're
it
up.
Me?
Yeah, you're up.
Oh, my third point was have a solid understanding of principles and a wide range of methods. I think we've already talked
it's
about
more,
that.
Yeah, it's more topic.
Yeah. Funny how we all overlap. Great minds think alike.
There you go.
Yeah, I mean, that's really just about, I mean, Jeremy, you talked about the challenges of lockdown when you had clients who were all sort of strength and power focused, keeping them engaged, keeping them focused and help and kind of selling them on having some different goals. I think one of the reasons, I mean, I've trained for 24 years now. So I started when I was 16, really started training, and I've never fallen off. And I think one of the reasons for that is I've never really had any goals. I've just valued how good it feels to train every day, whether it's going for a run, doing a kettlebell workout, lifting heavy, whatever it may be, I feel great after training. So, you know, that's led to me investing time in understanding the principles, but then also understanding a wide range of methods, and just having a whole heap of different tools that I can use to feel good each day. Training is kind of like my drug. Like today, I've had a really bad week of recovery scores on my HRV. And so I thought, all right, I'm gonna have a pretty easy week of training. And today my recovery score was a bit higher, but I thought, all right, I'll still do an easy kind of session. And so I did a 30-minute session where I did 5 heavy kettlebell swings, 3 chin-ups, 5 dips. And I literally just walked around that for 30 minutes. And I felt amazing by the end of it because it was alactic. I didn't do one set to failure. But the total volume of how many rounds I did of that in 30 minutes, I can really feel it now. It woke me up, it fired up my nervous system, and it was just one of many methods that I can sort of reach into to have that drug of exercise each day and feel great.
And that feel good drug of
and you know, that's given me learning those methods and understanding the principles behind them has earned me a pretty good living for the last 15 years because I've got all these tools I can deploy based on the situation as I read it.
That's where, like, back to sort of my point, my second point was understanding different ways of training. Like, you might train someone for a specific way, a reason, and that training needs to be hard. It needs to be programmed, it needs to be very structured to get that person to that goal. That's where, like, Jeremy's a specialist coach, is like that. But someone else might come in and go, I just want to feel better. And what we spoke about, that you might then tap into another set of your skills, and you can understand good amount of volume that's going to help them progress on their health and fitness journey, but it's there to make them feel good than and leave them crushed and feeling ruined at the end of a session.
Totally.
Which is a huge for your point.
Just gives you more tools to solve the problems with. If you have a wider base of knowledge.
Come with you, the old problem solver.
That's it.
And you know what's funny if you use a wide range of things for a long period of time, you get pretty good at everything. Like on any given day, you know, if I was to test across a spectrum of tests across a number of different fitness qualities, I'd hold up really well against most people. You know, if it was strength, endurance, muscular endurance, power, I'd hold up pretty well because I've covered all my bases for a long period of time. So yeah, it sort of soaks in over that period of time. Not CrossFit Games, but
CrossFit banner, and talk a bit of shit about that before.
Let me tell you, when the Opens were on last year, I think one of the workouts, I think it was it 19.2? I think that was the one where it was the overhead bar to overhead, and you had to do a certain amount of over the bar burpees.
Oh yeah, like it was a 20. I think it was a 27, 21, 15, 9. Shoulder overhead, burpee over bar.
It was something like that. I looked at it, I thought, oh yeah, you know, I feel like a hard workout today.
Feel like I'll get that in 3 minutes.
And I'd actually seen one of my mates, Dan Cooper, who's been on the podcast. He's an ex Special Forces dude, and he's been to CrossFit Regionals, and he's training for a 1,000-mile ultra marathon at the moment. I saw him post on his Instagram that he'd just done that workout in under a certain time, and you know, it felt good to be able to still go at a decent pace. And he's 44, and I thought, yeah, fuck yeah, if he can do it, I can do it. I think I got 2 minutes into it.
Didn't you stop?
2 minutes into getting my big ass over that bar doing burpees, I was like, fuck this, I'm out. So, you know, there's always something that'll humble you, despite me just talking myself up. I can still be humbled.
You didn't say much of gymnastics stuff.
Oh, the over the bar burpees after about, I think I'd done a cumulative of 20, I was like, yeah, fuck this, I'm out. Oof, went and did some curls.
Oh dear.
Jono, third point for you.
My third was lifestyle versus diet, and just helping people disassociate with deprivation and negatives and get them to associate with education, integration, and empowerment. So a big part of that is teaching them why they're doing things, not just how, and just really having a good look at the obesity epidemic and understanding why that a lot of, like 70% of the country is overweight, and there's a weight loss industry that's preying upon people with certain behavioural patterns, and helping people understand how they actually need to make change, because a lot of the time they just stop doing the behaviours that got them the results in the first place, and they put all the weight back on. We need to get them to integrate those behaviours into their identity for sustainable change, changing perceptions. It's not just an A to B. It's not just a time frame we're looking at. It's A to infinity. This is for you, the rest of your life.
Infinite A's.
There you go.
Infinite A's.
Oh, that's got a ring to it, isn't it?
Yeah, infinite A's. And it is, you know, you can tell a lot by people's language. You know, if you hear people talk about, oh, I haven't had a ciggy for 20 days versus I don't smoke. You know, there's subtle differences in the language there, but they mean everything. And it's the same with, I'm on a diet at the moment.
I'm not going to be in 2 weeks, though.
I'm doing a challenge at the moment. I mean, we do this six-week challenge thing purely to get people in and go, yep, 6 weeks, you're going to get great results. By the way, you need to do this forever. That's the game. And, you know, one of the...
And they know that, like...
People know it deep down. Yeah, they know it deep down.
They know it, but it's just they don't want to be told. Yeah. And you have conversations with them all the time. You're like, this is the start. This is a 6 week challenge to start. This is to get your foot in the door.
Yeah.
But you are going to learn things here that you hopefully will carry with you for the rest of your life, because it will make you feel better. And what's the goal? The goal is to feel good every day.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I see a lot of my colleagues throughout the industry, rubbish, you know, shit talking 6 week challenges, etc. And they, I've seen quite a few of my colleagues shit talk gyms that do challenges or challenge gyms, and I just think, no, you guys are missing the point. This is how you actually build a business. This is how you influence more people. You know, you tell people a bit of, you tell them what they want to hear at the start, but then give them what they need and help them with that behavioral change by just reframing it. All right, cool. You've come in here for a 6 week challenge, but I'm sure we can both agree this is a longer term job.
And even if that's not something that is said at the start, like even if it's like they're literally here for a 6-week challenge and they think it's going to change their life forever.
Mm.
Mm.
Yes, it will if you continue it. And they get like 4 to 5 weeks into it and they realize like, I feel so good doing this.
Mm.
I know if I stop, I'll get back to where I was and then I'm going to start again.
They're on the drug.
Well, no one's going to come in the door if you give them a program that's called, this is the rest of your life program. You've got to do this from now until you die in order to successfully lose weight. Who's going to walk in the door?
Totally, man.
Not one.
Here's the training agreement. As you can see, you're signing up for life. Total lifetime value of $89,327.22.
Up front or
weekly direct debit? Yeah, it's the same with the food stuff here. You know, it's the infinite A. It's just selling people on what they need to do each and every day.
Yeah, totally. Yeah,
and that's where it's so important to learn that you do not have to be this chicken and broccoli every meal.
Mm.
Those lean behaviors, like you can do not so perfect things as long as you're doing more lean behavior things than you are fat behavior things.
Yeah, yeah.
Overweight. Like, it's a balance, and it's a balance game. And like, once you learn that, myself and you, Dan, had a conversation a while ago about eyeballing meals, and like, we spoke to someone about like, you must track your calories as a trainer, like to show that you're tracking your calories. If you're in a sport that is like a weight-based sport, you need to know what your weight is. You need to know how to up and down your weight. Like that's something you need to know.
Mm.
But we spoke about, because you've done it for so long, you can look at a meal and guess what's on your plate. That's hard for a beginner, but if you do it long enough, you kind of integrate those systems and understandings of what food should look like, and then when you feel like you're losing a bit of weight, you just add a little bit extra food to it, and you know, because you've eyeballed and you've learned those things, that you can put those into, you know, you don't have to then weigh every single meal that you have.
It's getting to the point of intuitive eating, basically, but you've got to do your time in the trenches first.
100%, yeah.
It's pretty hard to get fat if you're training each day and you eat, you know, a certain spectrum of foods. It's actually hard.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you got to try hard. If you're eating meat and vegetables and fruit, nuts.
I've been trying to put on weight for the last 6 months and it's like, oh, sweet, fortnight, I've put on 200 grams.
Yeah.
And other people come up to me and they're like, oh, God, I put on 10 kilos in a week. And I'm like,
what are you doing?
Well, yeah, like there's got to be something that you're doing that you are probably doing without an understanding of what it's actually doing, or you're not telling me.
Yeah.
It's like,
well, look, what as a high value activity, to finish up here, we've got about 10 minutes to go. What do you guys think are some of the really hidden mistakes that people make? I mean, I'll go on the record first up just to get it rolling here. I think one of the really common errors that people make is they eat a reasonable three amount, you know, they eat what looks to be reasonable, but especially people who are a little bit wealthier, they eat at restaurants a lot and they're consuming a lot of vegetable oil and sugar that they wouldn't otherwise consume if they're just preparing their own food. Mm-hmm. Now, vegetable oil has been shown to have a terrible effect on insulin sensitivity, which we know obviously comes with big problems for weight loss. And then sugar is a flavoring product within sauces and different kinds of food, not just desserts, but savory meals.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's one of the common things that people who otherwise think they're eating well might run into when it comes to weight gain. What are some of the other stuff that you guys have seen? Obviously, Jeremy, you talked about the poor reporting skills or the poor tracking skills.
Yeah, I think that added sugar thing to savory meals, I think it might have a small effect, but I think that's probably just through desensitizing you to what a sweet thing tastes like.
Mm.
Therefore, maybe make you overeat a sweet thing because you're less sensitive to it. So it's not as sweet, so therefore you overeat. I think one of the main ones would just be mindless snacking and also overconsumption of liquid calories, whether it be
port
or any alcohol or any sodas, anything.
Snacking's
like that.
Snacking's my one. Like, I actually, and it's like people argue with me all the time, I say, you should not snack. I'm like, don't snack. Yeah. I don't snack if I ever, like, unless I'm trying to put weight on for a reason, snacking is like, you shouldn't need to snack.
I'm a snack monster.
I just love a snack. That's just my personal opinion.
I agree with you. I think that if you're mindful about it, you can definitely cut it out, and that's definitely going to have benefits. I mean, both from an energy balance and digestive health perspective.
Of course, it depends on what you're snacking on as well. But correct, in terms, just for someone Doritos with no knowledge, just Doritos and custard, delicious combo.
Yeah.
Just for someone who has minimal knowledge, minimal care, that's just an easy way to stack up calories. Another couple, which are very important, would just be protein intake being too low on average, meaning protein is very satiating, so if you eat a lot of it, you'll feel full. Just under-eating protein and also under-eating fiber, which is also very filling. Therefore, you can over-consume on a lot of other things because it's all processed shit that has no fiber, no protein.
Low volume, high energy density.
Exactly. And it's so easy to overeat.
Like and you're hangry. Like, I've fucked up my meal prep a couple of times over the last fortnight and haven't had enough protein, and it's like this insatiable hunger I've got all day. I'm like, there's a child, I'm going to kill that child and eat it. You know, anything to get more protein by the it's not my child, it's someone else's child, so it's okay. But yeah, you'll do anything just to find it. And you tend to want more sugary things once you get to that point. So you can see how people get into that cycle.
It's because they get very hungry, because they have low protein, low fiber, and sugar is not filling, but sugar is higher energy. So you crave those kind of foods when you're hungry, because that's how you stop being in a deficit or starving to death, essentially, which is what makes you hungry.
It's kind of too, like, just being in a deficit, if you're trying to drop overall body weight and just body fat, like, you need to learn how to be hungry. Like, I think that's something that I know what it's like as well. Being a type 1 diabetic, food has been a massive game changer in understanding different ways of eating and timing and all that sort of stuff. Like, when you're trying to lose weight, there is going to be points where you are hungry. It's just like you can't deal with that. But as long as you're trying to have a high protein diet, trying to eat the foods with more fiber, trying to feel fuller with the calories you can have, you're gonna obviously come across a lot less. But there needs to be points in your diet where you're like, I'm hungry, I'm gonna get through this somehow.
Totally agree. It's gonna be all right.
Drink a good glass of water and wait 15 minutes first. Look, the big one for me in my experience is normally what happens if someone doesn't achieve what they wanted to with body comp or weight loss, it's because of self-monitoring. It's really a difference between driving a car or driving a car with a blindfold on, basically. If you're not going to track, then you'll have to sacrifice by some other means. So that would mean sticking to a certain type of eating, whether it's ketogenic or whether it's a point system, like Weight Watchers or something like that. If you're not going to track in some way, you have to sacrifice in another way. And that's really make or break.
That intuitive eating, like you're saying, should be something you work towards, but there needs to be...
Can't do it straight away. You've got
to... It needs to be tracking.
I'd say at least 6 to 12 months of tracking before you can get to that point.
Interesting. All right, lads. Thanks for your time. It looks like this is actually recorded. So big win today.
Bonus.
Jeremy, where can people follow you if they want to find out more about your unicorn ways?
Unicorn ways, catalyst_SAP on Instagram or catalystsap.com.au.
For all you TikTokers, check out
Jason Singleton Fitness across all platforms. Twitter, Instagram,
OnlyFans,
TikTok.
He's everywhere.
Facebook, everywhere. Just
Tinder?
That's just my name. So.
Okay, Jason Singleton on Twitter. Jono.
Raven Lifestyle Transformations, or just my personal Facebook page, Jono Hopwood.
There we go. All right, lads, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
Thank you.